The Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129 presents America This Week, a smart Catholic take on faith and culture with Father Matt Malone and Carrie Weber.
Good day. I'm Carrie Weber, executive editor for America Magazine, and my co-host, Father Matt Malone, is traveling today. And I am joined by Jim Keane.
Hi, Carrie. How are you?
Good. And here each week, we offer you the news and analysis from the intersection of the church and the world, gathered by our team at America. And with us today also is our national correspondent, Mike O'Loughlin.
Hey, Carrie.
Glad to have you here.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
Mike is often based in Chicago, but today...
I'm in New York.
The big city, the Big Apple.
Slightly bigger city than Chicago.
we don't want to diminish Chicago, which is in true. And of itself a large city.
A wonderful American city.
Which, yeah, you live there.
It's true.
I mean, making it that much better.
It's wonderful.
Well, thank you both for joining us today. We're really very glad to be here. And speaking to his own past and to the potential change that it will bring for his life and for our society is John Miller, who is here with us today. He's a former reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He's a great writer. He's contributed to us a number of times. So welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks so much for having me, Carrie.
So your article is called My Ancestor Owned 41 Slaves. What do I owe their descendants? This is a pretty heavy question. And I wonder if we can just start with how you learned about this information in the first place.
I have a cousin who is fascinated by genealogy, and she's spent much of the last 10 years just digging into family history of all kinds. And I think in 2013, she found out that there was a man in Texas in the 1840s who was my great-grandmother's grandfather who had enslaved 41 people. And this was a big shock. I sort of assumed this was true. I grew up in Brussels. My parents are expatriates from the U.S., but I knew that they had roots going back into the 18th century of Irish and English and Scottish immigrants, many of whom had embraced slaveholding as a way of life. But what really struck me is how close it was, that this was, I knew my great-grandmother. She was lived to be 98, I think, and I was 10 when she died, so I have memories of her physically. And it was her grandfather who had enslaved 41 people. So the fact that it was that close made it seem like history was very close in the way that I had never, it never hit me like that before. And so I kind of resolved, I thought, you know, this is pretty interesting. I'm a writer. You know, here's something I should be writing about. And so that's what planted the seed that turned into this piece.
And you talk a bit about how as you sort of sought to write about this topic, you realized that something that you had been able to kind of look at as like an interesting part of your family history was in fact, you know, something affecting the daily reality of a lot of other people.
It was very intellectual to me, and my first draft of the story was kind of, oh, here's something interesting. And it got rejected by pretty much any media organization you care to name, New York Times, Washington Post, everybody said no. And as I started talking to more African-American historians, I figured out why. It's that there's a kind of obliviousness that a lot of white Americans have towards slavery still, that it doesn't impact their family. Whereas if you're African-American and you see the poverty and other consequences of slavery, it's obvious that it's had an impact. If you live in the North, your family probably migrated from the South in the 20th century after Reconstruction. So slavery is something that's there. It's a ghost that haunts you every day. And it's not the case for white American families. So as I sort of integrated that into my thinking and started reporting on what some white Americans were doing to try to atone for slavery, it became a reported piece and something that actually was better. And America got the best version of this story, I'm happy to say.
We're happy to say that, too. Yeah.
John, something I found interesting in your story was you were talking about people atoning for this past, for this history, but you talked about this tension between symbolic actions and doing something more than symbolism. Can you explain why there's tension there?
So a big question amongst African-American thinkers and historians is still the question of reparations, which this country has paid out to other groups. For example, Japanese Americans in the 1980s, whose families had been interned during World War II, received cash payments. Germany compensated Israel for the Holocaust. So this historical precedent of nations doing this kind of thing. And so it's still a question whether this bill that was introduced by John Conyers, a congressman from Michigan in the 80s, which calls for state reparations, whether it's going to ever have a legislative life in this country. And people still hope that it will. And so on the side, you have white Americans doing private reparations, which involves doing things like starting scholarship funds or putting up plaques or kind of just making an acknowledgement that your family has a tie to enslaving people in the past.
And what are some of the arguments, or why is there so much resistance to reparations in this case, if there's been other cases, like you said, that where it has happened in this country?
Right. So to go back to your previous question, so symbolic action would be what African-Americans historians call like doing that kind of thing, like starting a scholarship fund or putting up a plaque. That many people see that as just symbolic. And so a full sort of societal reparation is what they call full restoration. So they believe that to really atone, to really make it right in some way, or at least lay down a symbolic sort of level of atonement, that state reparations is the only thing that matters. That if you care about this, you should campaign for state reparations with your congressperson, and you should try to make that happen and lobby for that. And anything else is just symbolic.
You talk a little bit about the difference between confession and atonement. So maybe the symbolic actions are...
So that was kind of my journey was it started with confession, with saying, oh, my family has had a role in this. And then realizing that just writing about it, it just came off as kind of trite and not that serious, that as a white American who benefits from a society that still in many ways was built on slavery, that just talking about it is sort of... It doesn't really make that big of a difference. It just comes off as tone deaf. And that the fact that African American families have had this or still live with this ghost is something that deserves deeper questioning.
So how did you go about kind of talking to people about this? It's got to be kind of an unusual conversation starter when you call up a historian or a academic and say, so, you know,
it is. And I had, you know, some African-American historians who were not angry, but kind of, you know, challenging me, like, you know, didn't you always know, like, wasn't there, and I grew up in Brussels, so it's kind of a weird question. I didn't learn about American slavery in school. And obviously I knew about it, but I just tried to listen. I you know, felt very humble asking people about this. But I mean, once they realize that you're doing serious reporting and that you care and that you're reporting on all the sides and that you are actually looking up stories of people who are doing this kind of symbolic atonement. I met a woman named Christina Brown who made this movie called Traces of the Trade about her Rhode Island family that had enslaved thousands of people in the 19th century. And she is part of this network called Coming to the Table, which brings together descendants of people who were enslaved and people who had enslaved other people. And so they try to build community around that and basically bringing the truth out into the light, which is something I care a lot about.
Right, sure. Yeah, absolutely.
One point you made here in the story, John, that you can everyone can read that at americamagazine.org, is that in some ways places like Germany, in the aftermath of World War II, they really did have a reckoning with what they had done to the Jewish people and to other populations. But Americans have a hard time seeing slavery as, in some ways, a real defeat in our national purpose and our morality, and we have a hard time coming to terms with it as a nation.
I'm sorry, Mike asked that question before, and I didn't properly answer it. Yeah, that's right. A lot of Americans, and there's a number in the story surveyed, don't believe that any reparations are necessary. There's kind of like this sort of willing blindness towards slavery. Like we like to pretend the South was glorious. And if you go visit, this always has struck me as a tourist, if you go visit plantations, there's this veneer of nostalgia that surrounds plantations. And there's almost this description of, you know, the slaves were happy and this kind of thing, which is just, you know, sort of morally abhorrent. If you really think about it, it's not okay. And so there's still this sort of blocked mindset towards that. And there's also this idea of, you know, in the 80s especially, there was this political movement of personal responsibility and, you know, this idea that, you know, people in America are responsible for their lot, you know, even if their ancestors were enslaved 100 years ago or 150 years ago. And so that current of sort of self-reliant American ethic, I think, makes it harder to argue for reparations.
Right.
Is there a difference in talking about the reparations, what it there's an atonement there. Is what is expected in return? Is are people asking for forgiveness? Are they asking for resolution? What is the sort of relationship of that transaction?
You mean, but from African Americans?
Yeah, like do you think like reparations are truly a way of asking for forgiveness, or is it sort of like, look, we're settling this deal? You know, how do people view it?
So the general consensus among African American historians is that it's up to the people who are wrong to set the terms of reparation. That there would be some kind of committee that would say everybody who's descended from an enslaved person would get a cash payment of $10,000 or some amount, and they would set that terms. And then by agreeing to those terms, the United States would effectively atone for slavery, and then we could move on. That's kind of the thinking amongst the African American historians I interviewed.
Well, and it makes sense in a lot of ways, because a lot of the repercussions through the years that people deal with now are, in fact, financial ones.
And I interviewed an Italian academic, actually, who did a very interesting survey looking at education levels, and found that there was a consistent correlation between education levels of African Americans and whether that county or that region had slavery. Hmm. That the higher the incidence of slavery, the lower the level of educational attainment now. And yeah. So that was a clear correlation.
There's a lot of long-term effects, for
That's
sure.
Right. That's right.
The question of what is owed in situations of slavery is one the church is asking and has been asking as well, particularly the Jesuits, actually. The Maryland province of the Society of Jesus owned slaves and then sold those slaves to finance the start of Georgetown University.
Yeah, and I think, Carrie, this is something that for a long time, just recently, the university and the province sort of came forward and said, this was a wrong that we committed and we are asking for forgiveness. But it wasn't that long ago, and I think the history, the church has not always had a great record on this stuff.
No.
And for a long time, the Jesuits defended their actions by saying, well, we kept the families together. As if owning another person was a salutary effect, and that they said, well, we were nicer to them than most slaveholders were. And so this has been a very welcome development, I think, saying, no, we did something that was morally wrong, and we have to accept responsibility.
Sure, and Georgetown has been trying to do some of the things that you've been describing, John, those sort of personal actions of atonement, or sort of smaller scale as their individual institution. And they've been offering scholarships to any of the descendants of the enslaved peoples that they had owned, and working on some other. So I think they're putting up a plaque.
So that's an example of private atonement, which I'm talking about. I talk about in the story,
yeah.
Which contrasts with state reparations, which a lot of African American historians still think is the better way to go.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, Jim, the church's history on this has not always been great. There's always been sort of individual Catholics who have been involved in this movement, but the church itself has not had a lot to say on this issue when it seems like it probably should have. So recently the bishops put out their pastoral letter on racism, which was the first in 40 years.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, if you look at from a historian's perspective, if you look at some of the major figures in the church's history in the U.S., so you take someone like Dagger John Hughes, the Archbishop of New York, he's an Irishman who identified very strongly with the lower class Irish who were coming into the city, who were notoriously racist towards African Americans. Mm. And he had those same attitudes. And so you read, it can be very cringeworthy to read about him. You can read a biography that's very praiseworthy of him, but you have to deal with this reality, is that he did not see African Americans as equal to him. And the same with Doc Bunn, who was a famous Jesuit who's president of Georgetown University, is also famously in favor of segregation.
Right. Yeah, the church has a lot to grapple with.
John, I wanted to ask you about this group that you wrote about called Coming to the Table. It's a nonprofit, and you write that they want to inject more awareness into the public space about links between slavery and current inequalities. And I'm just curious, some people say that this is history, that their families came over after slavery ended, that there's no need for reparations because they weren't involved with it. But how does this idea that there are still links between slavery and inequalities today, how does that or how should that inform that conversation?
So their argument is that anybody who is white in this country benefits from a system of privilege that was built on the backs of slavery, and that the wealth that was accumulated and built up in white communities benefited from slavery. So even if you're Irish and you came over in 1910, and obviously your family has no connection to owning slaves in this country, that you benefited from that system, which is an argument that is disputable, obviously, if your family does not have a direct connection. But that's the argument they do make. And Coming to the Table organizes frequent conferences. They publish a guide to if you discover that your family has a connection to slave owning, which is more and more frequent, by the way, thanks to the online genealogy revolution. Ancestry.com and 23andMe make it way more easier than before. You might find out you have a cousin who's African-American that you didn't know about. And Ancestry.com has published the slave schedules of the 1850 and 1860 census, which lists the not the names, but the ages and genders of people that were enslaved. And so if your family has a census report that says that, then the connection's obvious. And so that's forcing many people into this realization, which happened in my family. And so Coming to the Table has published a guide on how to approach that. It counsels, for example, being very humble in the approach and making it clear that you're not insisting on a relationship with somebody who might be descended from people your family enslaved, that you're offering the opportunity for dialogue. And it hopes to promote more awareness. And they are for state reparations. They encourage campaigning for state reparations, which would need to be a bill signed into law or passed by Congress.
Right. And in a lot of ways, those larger actions are very useful in and of themselves, but also to make sure that the conversation being had is not simply about yourself, right? And like, oh, well, I feel this way about this. And you know, other people might be like, great, but I'm dealing with this still, you know, and it's not, it takes it outside of just your own reactions.
That's right, which is kind of the journey that I went on from this being something interesting I discovered to feeling genuinely, you know, shaken by how present it is in African-American families. And I had conversations with African-American friends that were sort of sparked by this research I was doing. And it was very moving to kind of connect on that level of sensitivity and to be able to listen to them in a new light, which I had not sort of been attuned to before.
Right, right. Yeah, I would imagine so.
I'm curious, in your own family, has there been any kind of disagreement or debate about what you owe or your family would owe to others?
There's a sense that this was a long time ago and that, you know, it's kind of not that useful. But nobody is hostile towards this kind of thing. I haven't really decided. I mean, I support reparations in a way I didn't before, but I haven't, you know, started the scholarship fund. I'm sort of still thinking about it. It's pretty fresh. So I don't know if my family is, you know, that people are, they feel guilty, but there's not a strong sense either way. I guess acknowledging the truth and sort of being ashamed of it in a way, but not, you know, obviously overcome to the point of paralysis. But yeah, being aware that there's a wrong there that is still present. I think that's happened in a positive way in my family.
Yeah. And what do you see sort of moving forward in terms of what conversations are most useful?
So Coming to the Table reports that since the Trump election and sort of resurgence of white nationalism in this country, that there's been an increase in interest in coming to the table and trying to reaffirm dialogue and kind of engage on a more truthful level. I mean, the political environment right now is very fraught, obviously. And so I think the most useful conversation is just acknowledging the truth and going from there and giving voice to this argument. It's very important, the argument about atonement and private reparations. And I don't think anybody argues that starting a scholarship fund for the descendants of people your family enslaved is bad necessarily, but it shouldn't obscure that there's a greater wrong that our society still lives with every day today.
Right. Yeah. And I think sometimes one of the most frustrating things about the kinds of conversations being had today is people seemingly unable to agree upon sort of what the wrong is or whether there still is a wrong or, you know, those basic facts. You know, it's such a loaded word these days. Somehow the actual truth is flexible or debatable. That can complicate these conversations because, you know, I think I don't think that it is debatable that the effects of slavery have affected generations after each other. But
one thing that struck me, and this is not in the story, but my cousin dug up these diaries that one of my great 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 grandmothers had kept, and in the diaries they're written in the 1860s and 70s, and she describes the slaves being freed, and then they're living in the village around the family, and she describes like her fear of these people that her family had enslaved a decade ago before the Civil War. And she writes about how they bought these new dogs to protect themselves against the African Americans living in that village. And you just see like this sort of structure of fear and inequality and tension that starts in the 1860s and just keeps going, and one year leads to another, and we're in 2019, and you still have fear, you still have tension, you have millions of African Americans incarcerated, you have urban ghettos, and I see a direct connection even more so having done this research.
In your research, were there any moments of hope that things could get better from here, or are we entering a time where things seem to be getting worse? I'm curious what you think.
I think the stories of people reconnecting, there's a woman profiled in my story who found the descendant of people that her family had enslaved, and the African-American woman was initially resistant to being friends, but they ended up forging a relationship. And so those personal connections, I think, are healing. If the people say they're healing, then they're healing. And so those stories do give me hope.
Well, there's a real vulnerability on both parts there, I think. And because I could see where the African-American woman you mentioned being contacted would be like, it's not my job to like make you feel better about
That's
what
right.
your family did. Like, you don't use me as like this salve on this situation. But being willing to be open and to be present to that person is a real gift.
That's right. And coming to the table is a good organization. It's based out of Eastern Mennonite University, and they have frequent conferences. So if our listeners are interested, you can just Google them. They have a nice website with the guide I mentioned. And Ancestry.com has people that help you deal with this kind of thing, too. I interviewed one of them. So there's lots of resources. And African-American genealogy centers are happy to have your contributions, by the way. If you find out stuff about your family, they want you to tell them what you know. Mm. Because a lot of record keeping of African-American life in the 19th century is incomplete. And so if you can donate your family archives, you can help them build a better understanding of their past. And that's very valuable and healing, too.
Sure.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, John, to think about the way, if there's examples from other countries that of ways we could do sort of social reconciliation on the model of this that would help people sort of have some healing, also economic, you know, restitution. But, you know, around the world, if there are other countries that were able to do this, I think of South Africa with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission they had, or if there's some method like that that would be helpful.
South Africa and Germany are the two countries mentioned as sort of models for this, where a more harmonious kind of dialogue has been built out of intense suffering and hatred. And they're seen as models, both in kind of concrete steps that were taken in terms of state reparations, but also the kind of dialogue and intellectual kind
right.
of peace that came out of these conversations.
Right, and that's it can be very dramatic and sort of heart-wrenching, but then you do see positive results, yeah.
True.
Yeah. Is there anything else you would hope readers or listeners would want to, should know about this story or about steps forward?
I would say that this one of the people in my story, a source, points out that just mathematically, if you're a white American, there is a very high percentage chance that you're descended from somebody who had enslaved people, and that it's part of all our history. So to be curious about your own family and to not be afraid to engage on what the truth is, because we're all, you know, descended from the past in some way, and it has shaped our lives. And it's the best basis for having a shared life is accepting that the past is real and that it impacted us and helped us or hurt other people in different ways.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks very much for your time today and for your work for the magazine.
Thanks for having me, Carrie.
Thank you for listening as well. That was John Miller. You can find out more about his work and the new documentary he's got out called Moundsville, based on one of his America articles, at americamagazine.org/serious, where you can find more of our content and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, all the social media. And you can learn more about how to subscribe to the magazine or call 1-800-627-9533. 3 for Jim Keen and Michael O'Loughlin and myself. Thanks very much for listening.
You're listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.